Welcome back to the Deep Dive. We've gotten some really thought-provoking stuff from you guys, listeners, exploring the identity of God's people in the Old Testament.
Yeah, it's kind of like we're on this archaeological dig trying to unearth the core elements that made this ancient community tick, you know, what defined them.
Absolutely. What set them apart?
Yeah.
And the material you sent, it really dives deep into some foundational areas. So in this deep dive, we'll be focusing on five key aspects.
Five, yeah.
That define God's people way back then. Atonement, their unique worship, their connection to the land, the role of prophecy, and the long-awaited Messiah.
You got it. We'll be unpacking the most crucial insights from the theological analyses of Old Testament scriptures you shared.
Our aim here is to kind of extract those aha moments, the ones that help us grasp those fundamental concepts shaping the people of God in the Old Testament and why they still matter today, even after all these centuries.
Right.
So let's kick things off with this idea of atonement. Your sources approach it from a bunch of different angles.
They do. Atonement, it's the heart of the matter, really. Mm. The material touches on the Levitical sacrifices, the Day of Atonement, the whole system. But I think zeroing in on Isaiah's portrayal of the servant of the Lord's sacrifice in chapters 52 and 53 will give us a powerful lens.
Yeah, I was drawn to that section too. It's described as the Old Testament's most extensive passage on the Messiah's atoning death. And it doesn't sugarcoat the suffering involved.
No, it doesn't.
Verses 14 of chapter 52 and verse 7 of chapter 53 are very vivid. It's powerful, that image of being marred beyond human likeness, the servant led like a lamb to the slaughter.
Right. It really hits you. And while the Old Testament has various atonement themes, the sacrifice aspect really takes center stage here.
Hmm.
Even just that image of the lamb being led to slaughter, it screams sacrifice.
It's verse 10, right, that just lays it out, that explicit language. His soul makes an offering for guilt. No ambiguity there.
None at all. And it immediately begs a question, how could a loving God intentionally crush this righteous servant, as the verse also says, especially when verse 9 says he was innocent? He'd done no violence, spoken no deceit. Seems like a contradiction, doesn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. It's a puzzle on the surface, but your sources do a good job of illuminating two key points that resolve this tension.
Exactly. First, the servant offered himself willingly, poured out his soul to death, verse 12 says. This wasn't forced on him. It was a deliberate choice.
And second, which seems even more central, is this substitutionary aspect of his suffering. It keeps popping up in verses 5, 6, 8, 11, and 12. He's suffering for others.
You got it. And this is where the link to the guilt offering or a sham in Leviticus 5 comes in. Verse 10 specifically links the servant's soul making a guilt offering. It connects back to that core principle. God demands justice when his covenant is broken. And it finds ultimate resolution in this sacrifice.
Okay, so this guilt offering, the material explains it as emphasizing compensation or restitution for breaking faith, specifically Israel's disloyalty to the covenant. It's like setting things right after messing up that relationship with God.
Yeah, making things right. And furthermore, this offering provides a way to deal with every kind of sin, unintentional or deliberate, like it covers the whole spectrum.
Which then sets the stage for Isaiah in chapters 54 and 55. He shows how the servant's death becomes the basis for forgiveness, not only for Israel, but for all nations. Pretty groundbreaking concept in the Old Testament.
Yeah, huge implications. One of your sources, Peter Gentry, he talks about how the servant's life being given as a reparation offering opens up this possibility of universal forgiveness. Mm-hmm. However, it's important to point out a contrasting viewpoint here.
Right. The Jewish scholar Harry Orlinsky, he completely rejects this idea of substitutionary atonement, sees it as unjust.
Exactly. He argues that letting the guilty go free at the expense of the innocent would be the ultimate injustice. He says this doctrine has no basis in the Hebrew Bible, and it basically overrides the covenant, which, in his view, didn't allow for an innocent person to substitute for the guilty. Basically, Orlinsky sees this idea of one innocent person bearing the punishment for many as ethically problematic.
That's a strong counterargument, but then we have someone like Alan Groves coming in with a different take. He actually supports this penal vicarious atonement in Isaiah 53.9.
He does. Groves emphasizes the unique language Isaiah uses, how the servant bearing guilt is equivalent to making atonement. He sees Isaiah's prophecy adding a whole new layer to redemptive history. It goes beyond the Torah's idea of atonement to envision this universal, permanent purification all through this righteous Israelite's suffering. He even points to Isaiah 48.7, you know, where it says God is doing a new thing.
It's pretty fascinating how scholars can read the same verses and come to such different interpretations. But I think it's safe to say the material leans towards Isaiah uniquely predicting the Messiah's atoning work through these sacrificial terms.
It's a key takeaway. While the sacrificial system was there, Isaiah links it specifically to the future Messiah, something no other Old Testament book does. And Isaiah 53.3 goes on to show that this humiliation, it leads to exaltation for the servant.
Yeah. It mentions he shall see his offspring, prolong his days, and that the will of the Lord shall prosper in his hand. It almost sounds like a resurrection is being hinted at, a life beyond death.
Right. Like a continuation.
Yeah.
And your source even cites Alec Moyter's commentary, suggesting that the song anticipates the servant living after dying. So to sum it up, believing Israelites, they found forgiveness through their sacrificial system, but they were also looking ahead to this final, ultimate act of atonement by Isaiah's servant, maybe with different levels of clarity, but still.
Okay, that gives us a lot to think about regarding atonement. Let's shift gears now. Talk about another defining characteristic. Worship in the Old Testament. The sources you sent highlight how Israel's worship was distinct, set apart.
Totally. It wasn't simply about worshiping Yahweh. It was about worshiping him according to his specific instructions.
Yeah.
It all flows from what we just talked about, the covenant, God choosing Israel, their rescue from Egypt, God's very nature, his provision for dealing with their sin. All of it pointed towards this very specific form of worship, like an exclusive relationship with a God who'd revealed himself in incredible ways.
So where do your sources say this special way of relating to God began? When did this worship start taking shape?
Well, a lot of scholars point to Genesis 4.26, where it talks about the birth of Enosh and says, at that time, people began to call on the name of the Lord.
Yeah, it's more than just mentioning God, right?
Exactly. It's intentional. One of your sources, Jack Collins, he explains that this phrase, to call upon the name of a deity in Hebrew, it specifically means to invoke that deity in worship. And then we see it later, this phrase connected to building altars, public worship, Genesis 12, 13, 21, 26, all these places.
So it's like a pattern emerging.
Right. And Genesis 4.26 is seen by many as marking the start of regular structured worship of God.
Okay, so then we get to those foundational Ten Commandments. And right from the start, it's significant how God identifies himself. I am the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the place of slavery. It establishes that whole basis of the relationship.
Exactly. Sets the tone. And then boom, the first and second commandments all about exclusive worship of Yahweh and the no-go on idols. These weren't random rules. They came directly from God's character, his desire for that unique bond with his people.
You shall have no other gods besides me. And that command to not make or bow down to idols. The material mentions God's jealousy here, but also his love for those who obey. It's an interesting mix of, like, commitment and expectation.
It is. And one source, Paul House, he emphasizes how the Ten Commandments essentially declare all other so-called deities as powerless, and they demand exclusive worship of the one true God, the one who had acted on their behalf.
Beyond those core commands, there were those appointed feasts of Israel. They played a huge part in their worship, too. Leviticus 23 lays them all out, these appointed feasts of the Lord. What was the significance of those, the main takeaway?
You've got the Sabbath, Passover, the Feast of First Fruits, the Feast of Weeks, the Feast of Trumpets, the Day of Atonement, and the Feast of Booths. A whole cycle. And while offerings were part of it, the primary focus was worshiping and thanking God. Like, think about Passover, celebrating their escape from Egypt. Or Tabernacles, remembering God's provision in the wilderness. And later, Purim, celebrating deliverance from Haman. They weren't just remembering history, they were actively worshiping.
It kept those memories alive and relevant.
Yeah. Reminding them of God's faithfulness and prompting them to respond with gratitude.
We can't talk about Old Testament worship without talking about the tabernacle and the temple there.
Right.
Those structures were central to how they expressed their devotion to God.
Definitely. The tabernacle, built to a heavenly blueprint, as described in Exodus and Hebrews, so God could dwell among his people. It was like their portable worship center, with animal sacrifices culminating in the Day of Atonement. And when it was finished, God's glory filled it, a visible sign of his presence. Powerful stuff.
And then the temple came later, replacing the tabernacle. Worship really took off under King David. One thing that stood out in the material was how involved he was in the musical side of worship. He organized so many of the Levites specifically for musical service.
Yeah, music, choirs, instruments. It all became a big part of worship, with the Psalms being these inspired expressions of praise, lament, thanksgiving.
Like a soundtrack to their faith.
And even though David didn't actually build the temple, he made all these preparations. He really wanted it built. And then Solomon dedicated it. Again, we see that confirmation, fire from heaven, God's glory filling the temple, that image of God accepting their worship.
It's such a contrast to other ancient Near Eastern peoples and their worship, their temples and rituals. They seem so different.
Big time. While they also had temples, none were built according to God's specific instructions. None saw his glory like that. And most importantly, none focused on worshiping Yahweh, the Redeemer, the Covenant Maker. That relationship defined them.
It's a good reminder that their identity was tied to their obedience, even in how they worshiped. Okay, let's move on to the connection between the people of God and the land. This was a big theme in the material you sent.
It is. This connection, it's woven throughout the entire Old Testament story, from Eden to the Promised Land and ultimately to the new heaven and new earth. God always intended for his people to have a connection to the land.
It starts way back in Genesis, right? With Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden. That was their space, their land, in a way.
Exactly. And even after the flood, this huge judgment that wiped out almost all life because of evil, God promises Noah he'll never again destroy the earth with a flood. So that establishes continuity. The land matters. It's where God's story with humanity unfolds.
And then you have those promises to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Those weren't just personal promises. The land was at the center of it all.
Totally. That first promise to Abraham in Ur, it was multi-layered. Becoming a great nation, a great name, a blessing to others, and through him, all families, all nations, being blessed. But that very first command was to leave home and go to the land that God would show him. And this promise, it's repeated to Isaac and Jacob. Even though they didn't fully possess the land in their lifetime, they lived by faith in that future promise.
That's where Hebrews comes in. It talks about Abraham looking forward to a city with foundations whose builder is God himself. It hints at that ultimate dwelling place, heaven.
Right. And then we have that dramatic conquest of Canaan under Joshua. They did finally enter the promised land, even after all those years wandering in the wilderness because of disobedience.
And even though they didn't get full control right away, some Canaanites remained. The material points out that from God's perspective, he had kept his promise. He gave them the land.
Yeah. Joshua reminds them of what Moses said about God giving them rest in the land.
Mm.
Despite their imperfections, God saw his promise as fulfilled.
Then we get into those more complex times, the United Kingdom, the divided kingdoms, and ultimately exile from the land. It seems like it wasn't a permanent possession after all.
No, it wasn't. Initially, God's plan was for them to live securely in the land under a king who would rule according to his will. But they rejected God as their king, choosing Saul instead.
Which wasn't exactly what God had in mind.
No. But then God raised up David. His reign brought prosperity and saw the initial land promised to Abraham expanded. Solomon's reign, it stretched the kingdom even further, to its greatest extent.
But then, the division after Solomon's death, the northern kingdom, they fall away from God and they're exiled to Assyria. And later, the southern kingdom is exiled to Babylon. Even the temple is destroyed. That must have felt like the end of the land promise.
Yeah, like it was all over. But God, being God, he orchestrated their return from captivity through Cyrus, Ezra, Nehemiah. This return, it was vital. It reestablished them as a people connected to that land, a land that belonged to them because of God's covenant. Even in exile, their hearts yearned for Zion. Psalm 137 captures that so well.
And this return wasn't just about getting the land back. It was about spiritual renewal, rebuilding the temple, restoring Jerusalem. Your sources even quote Paul House talking about how the remnant needed to set themselves apart to fully inherit the land promised to Abraham.
Yeah, it was about starting fresh, recommitting. And this return is like a foreshadowing. A step towards that new covenant the prophets Jeremiah and Ezekiel talked about. And this new covenant, it points us to Jesus Christ, to that ultimate renewal, the new heaven and new earth.
So, the land promise. It's not just about that piece of land in ancient Israel. It's about this huge cosmic renewal.
Exactly. The new covenant, it's the ultimate fulfillment of the Abrahamic covenant, including the land promise, but on a universal level. Jesus, the mediator of this new covenant, his death and resurrection sealed it. Forgiveness, eternal inheritance, resurrection to eternal life on the new earth for all who believe. His work, it even goes beyond humans. He rescues the whole created order from its brokenness.
A redemption that encompasses everything. It's pretty amazing. Your sources mention Isaiah's visions of new heavens and new earth. Jesus talking about the renewal of all things, and Peter expecting a new creation where righteousness dwells.
Yeah, it all points to that final reality comes after Christ returns, after the resurrection, the final judgment. Then we have that glorious new heaven and new earth described in Revelation 21. God himself dwelling with humanity, no more death, sorrow, suffering, and God's people permanently planted in this renewed earth. It's that final union of their identity with his promised land. From creation to new creation.
Okay, so we've covered a lot of ground. But let's talk about prophecy and how the anticipation of the Messiah shaped God's people in the Old Testament. The prophets were obviously central to all of this.
Oh, absolutely. God tied his people closely to the prophets. They were his mouthpieces, delivering his word, his will. He warned them against those practices of the surrounding nations, all those abhorrent things. And he made it clear his people were to receive his guidance from a prophet like Moses, raised up from among them.
And there was a clear distinction between the true prophets and the false prophets.
Right. You couldn't just claim to speak for God.
There were consequences for ignoring the true prophets and for pretending to be one.
Huge consequences.
Yeah.
And the way you could tell a true prophet, their words would come true. It showed God's power was behind them. False prophets, they'd eventually be exposed. And the material you sent points out that this whole idea of prophecy in the Old Testament, it finds its ultimate fulfillment in Jesus Christ. He's the prophet Moses predicted.
So listening to and obeying God's word through these prophets, that's a key part of what it meant to be God's people back then.
Definitely. And their prophecies weren't just about predicting the distant future. They spoke to the present, the issues people faced right then and there.
Keeping them grounded.
They brought God's message to their contemporaries. Sometimes it was judgment, especially when people went astray. But it also included hope, the promise of redemption, restoration. And yes, they also foretold big events, like how Abraham's descendants would be enslaved, then experience that miraculous exodus with all those possessions, or Judah's captivity in Babylon for that specific time and Babylon's fall. Those fulfilled prophecies, they confirmed God's faithfulness, the truth of his word.
And then at the heart of it all were those predictions about the Messiah. Your sources highlight three main messianic themes running through the Old Testament: David's royal son, Isaiah's suffering servant, and Daniel, son of man. Let's start with that expectation of a king from David's line. It seems to stem from God's promise to David himself.
It does. God made this unshakable promise to David, assuring him of a great name, rest from his enemies, an enduring dynasty, a house that would continue through his descendants. He specifically promised that one of David's offspring would build a temple. And even bigger, God would establish his throne forever. That's the Davidic covenant.
And Isaiah, centuries later, he picks up on this. He prophesies about a special child, a son given to them, who would rule with perfect justice and righteousness on David's throne forever. Those names given to him, Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Eternal Father, Prince of Peace, they hinted at his divine nature, his purpose.
Definitely. And that beautiful phrase, for us a child is born, to us a son is given, it emphasizes how closely the Messiah identifies with his people. And the New Testament writers, they make it clear, Jesus is that promised son of David. Gabriel announces to Mary that her son Jesus will be called the Son of the Most High, given David's throne, and reign over Jacob's house forever.
It all connects, and Hebrews takes it even further. It presents Jesus as the ultimate royal son, crowned in glory at God's right hand. It directly links this to the Davidic covenant. So Jesus is the fulfillment of that Old Testament promise of a king from David's line reigning forever.
Precisely. He reigns now from heaven, and one day he'll reign in righteousness on the new earth. And God's people, they're the ones who bow to him, confess him as Lord.
Makes sense. Now, let's look at that second major messianic theme, Isaiah's suffering servant. We talked about atonement, but there's more to this image that helps us understand God's people.
Right. There's more to unpack. This servant in Isaiah's servant songs, especially the fourth ones, chapters 52 and 53, he goes through intense humiliation, suffering. But in the end, he's exalted. It's interesting how the material you sent points out the structure of that passage. The exaltation is at the beginning and the end. It frames the servant's experience.
It's like a story with a clear beginning, middle, and end.
Exactly. And despite all the suffering, the servant is always portrayed as sinless. His suffering is voluntary, redemptive. He willingly bears the sins of many and intercedes for them. Isaiah uses such strong language here. Substitution. He was pierced for our transgressions. Sacrifice. His soul makes an offering for guilt. And ultimately, this leads to the justification of many.
And as a result of this sacrifice, victory, he'll see his spiritual offspring, he'll live on, and God's will succeed through him. This righteous servant identifies with his people, making atonement for them, rescuing them.
Powerful stuff. And God's people in the Old Testament, they're defined as those for whom the servant would die, those whose sins would be forgiven through his suffering. And the number of times the New Testament quotes this section of Isaiah, it shows how crucial it is to understanding Jesus as the Savior.
Last but not least, Daniel's vision of the Son of Man. It's a unique image, that heavenly courtroom scene.
Definitely unique. Daniel 7. Daniel sees four terrifying beasts, and then there's this heavenly judgment. And he sees one like a Son of Man coming with the clouds of heaven. This figure is presented to God, the Ancient of Days, and given dominion, glory, and everlasting kingdom that everyone will serve. Now, Son of Man in the Old Testament, it usually emphasizes human weakness, but here, arriving with the clouds, that shows divine power. And being given this universal eternal rule, that points beyond just being human.
And Daniel's confused, right? But this one, like a Son of Man, he's connected to the saints of the Most High. They'll also receive this kingdom. It seems to have both an individual meaning and a corporate meaning, like a representative connected to the people themselves.
Exactly. It's both individual and collective. And while Son of Man often just means human in the Old Testament, Daniel's use of it, it adds these divine traits. And then Jesus comes along calling himself the Son of Man. And that title captures both his true humanity and his divinity, just like in Daniel's vision.
So it's all pointing to Jesus.
He is the ultimate Danielic Son of Man. And just like the Son of Man in Daniel has that individual and the corporate aspect, Jesus represents his people, loves them, dies for them, builds his church. Daniel's vision points to this connection between the Son of Man and God's people, and Jesus makes it explicit.
So in the end, God's people are the people of Jesus Christ, marked by his love, his sacrifice. That brings us to the end of our deep dive into the identity of God's people in the Old Testament. Quite a journey.
It is. We explored atonement through that servant sacrifice, the unique way they worshiped to the Old Testament, the significance of the land, and that anticipation of the Messiah. David's royal son, Isaiah's suffering servant, Daniel's Son of Man. It's all connected.
It really is. And what's so cool is how these Old Testament concepts, they're the foundation for understanding God's people in the New Testament. It all finds its fulfillment in Jesus.
Absolutely.
So thinking about these deep roots, what does it mean for you to be part of a people shaped by this history, these promises? It's something to keep thinking about long after this deep dive is over.